Good morning. On today's programme, the arrest and targeting of a Muslim sect for blasphemy in Pakistan and liftoff for the expansion of London's Gatwick Airport. But first we go to Canada, which has a new Prime Minister this weekend after Justin Trudeau's resignation. Economist and banker Mark Carney was sworn in on Friday morning as the country's 24th Prime Minister. He says his focus will be on the tariffs levelled by President Donald Trump and the Canadian economy. He has introduced a drastically pared-down cabinet, one which he says is focused on action. Dan Karpinchuk has this report.
The 59-year-old Carney took the oath during his swearing-in ceremony at Rideau Hall, the residence of the Governor-General, that he will be faithful and bear true allegiance to His Majesty King Charles III, King of Canada, his heirs and successors. That was followed by the swearing-in of his new team, a much smaller 23-member cabinet than under his predecessor Justin Trudeau. One of his first official moves was to get rid of the widely unpopular consumer carbon tax, a signature policy of the Trudeau government, and a target for opposition attacks from the federal Conservatives and several provinces for more than a year. He pledged to do that during his campaign for the leadership of the Liberal Party, and he has done just that. Mark Joseph Carney was born in Fort Smith in the Northwest Territories. He was raised in Edmonton, Alberta, the heartland of the right-wing Conservative Party. His paternal grandparents were Irish from County Mayo. In 1988, Carney graduated with a bachelor's degree in economics from Harvard University, going on to earn a master's degree at the University of Oxford in 1993 and a doctorate in 1995. In 2003, he joined the Bank of Canada as a deputy governor, and a year later was named a senior associate deputy minister for the Federal Finance Department. During the global financial crisis of 2008, Carney was the governor of the Bank of Canada, guiding the country's monetary policy, a position he held until 2013. He was then appointed as the governor of the Bank of England, steering the central bank's response to Brexit and the crisis over the COVID-19 pandemic. After that, he served in senior positions with Brookfield Asset Management and Bloomberg, and was also appointed as the United Nations Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance. He turned down the job of finance minister from Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper and became an informal advisor to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. After Trudeau announced in January that he would resign, Carney announced his intention to seek the leadership of the Federal Liberal Party, which he won in a resounding landslide victory earlier this month, capturing nearly 86% of the vote. He is now the Prime Minister, never having held a seat in Parliament, which is not unusual in Canadian politics, but he also comes to the job at one of the most difficult periods in Canadian history. President Donald Trump has started a trade war by imposing a 25% tariff on Canadian and Mexican steel and aluminum imports to the U.S. Trump also continues to float the idea of Canada as a 51st state, even suggesting economic force to break the country. Trump says more tariffs are to come. Canada has already retaliated and says it will continue to do so on a dollar-for-dollar basis. After convening his first cabinet meeting on day one, Carney said some decisions will be taken soon. He's already distanced himself from some of Trudeau's policies, such as a cabinet reflecting regional representation and gender parity. In a statement, Carney's office said this new, leaner, focused cabinet includes returning ministers, seasoned leaders, and new voices to bring fresh ideas as the cabinet delivers on things that matter most to Canadians, such as strengthening the country's economy and security. Among the dignitaries at the swearing-in ceremony was former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, now 91, who said being Prime Minister is a tough job, but he believes Carney will do very well. Meeting with reporters afterwards, Carney said his first trip abroad would be next week, after invitations from the leaders of France and Britain. As for Trump, Carney said nothing is planned yet, but efforts are underway to organize a call within the next couple of days. The Canadian Parliament is prorogued until March 24th, and even though an election doesn't have to be called until October, some analysts believe it will happen sometime next week, before Parliament resumes. That would allow Carney's Liberals to ride the momentum of the leadership race and the swearing-in to help the Liberals win a fourth mandate. Carney himself must win a seat, but he has yet to say when the election will be called and where he will personally run. The opposition Conservatives, who have been trying to bring the Trudeau government down for the past year, were also quick to criticize the new Prime Minister, saying it's the same Liberal gang with the same Liberal agenda. The Conservatives have had some difficulty in pivoting their campaign from Trudeau to Carney, and that's reflected in the polls. A couple of months ago, they had a 20-point lead over the Liberals, which would put them into majority government territory. But as of this week, the parties are running neck and neck. Until an election is called, Carney will be tested mainly on how he tackles Donald Trump, the tariffs, and Canadian sovereignty. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre will also face scrutiny, but some polls already show that voters have more confidence in Carney as prime minister than Poilievre, mainly because of his economic background. As for winning a seat for himself and a fourth mandate for the Liberals, some analysts comment that for Carney, all roads lead through the White House. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
To the UK next. The British government has given a green light to the expansion of London's Gatwick Airport, despite opposition to the plan to build a second runway. It follows the controversial decision to allow Heathrow, London's main airport, to build a third runway. The UK's Labour government sees airport expansion as a means to achieve economic growth, but environmental campaigners are complaining that it will create more carbon emissions, noise, and more traffic jams, as Russell Padmore reports.
Gatwick is Europe's busiest single runway airport, and the development would mean turning its emergency runway into a second one to allow more flights. The expansion will be privately funded with investment of £2.2 billion, about €2.6 billion. London's second airport, which is about 90 minutes by road south of the city, is known in the travel trade as a bucket and spade airport. In other words, it caters more for holidaymakers. A new runway would allow 100,000 extra flights a year, with annual passenger numbers increasing from 45 million to 75 million. The UK's Labour government has laid out a policy to prevent delays by planning authorities so that major infrastructure projects can be implemented quickly. It's worth noting that the planning authority had recommended rejecting Gatwick's second runway plan, but then suggested it would give a green light if the airport met certain conditions on noise and better public transport. Campaigners opposed to the expansion of the airport pointed out how the increase in toxic emissions would threaten the UK's commitments to reduce carbon emissions. And the airport operator said an extra 500,000 tonnes of CO2 would be created over the next 25 years, even if more aircraft started using greener fuel. It's likely opponents of the project to build a new runway at Gatwick saw their campaign headed for a crash landing when the government's transport minister, Heidi Alexander, told an industry conference that she had no intention of clipping anyone's wings. As she outlined her view that aviation was good for growth, she insisted, "I am not some sort of flight-shaming eco-warrior." Politicians have also caught a controversy by supporting plans for London's main airport, Heathrow, to build a third runway. The same conditions as Gatwick would apply, limits on noise and emissions. Heathrow, which caters for more business travellers, is said to be the most expensive airport in Europe. And with its landing slots, permission for airlines to operate there, changing hands for millions, it's no wonder carriers prefer to use other hubs like Gatwick, Stansted or Luton, which coincidentally also has plans to expand. Low-cost airlines like Ireland's Ryanair don't use Heathrow because the higher landing fees would mean more expensive fares. The controversy over the plan to expand Gatwick Airport will resonate with people in Ireland who followed the divisive debate around the cap on passenger numbers at Dublin Airport. The aviation industry says more flights will bring an economic benefit, boosting tourism and providing more jobs. Environmental campaigners warn that aviation is responsible for carbon emissions, which are blamed for climate change. And it's understandable that people who live near an airport, like Dublin, don't want to suffer more noise from low-flying aircraft, as well as traffic jams. In recent years, I've interviewed several bosses of airlines and airports about the challenges of expanding their business. Michael O'Leary from Ryanair is very outspoken about politicians and environmental campaigners. But I recall an interesting conversation with the late Theodore Vasilakis, founder of Aegean Airlines in Greece. The new airport in Athens was due to be opened, and he was battling to get a few check-in desks for Aegean when the Greek national carrier Olympic seemed to control everything. He said he felt his legal battles against the state and the airport made him feel like he was running a firm of lawyers, not an airline. Previous generations would have considered flying as a luxury and not for ordinary people, but that's changed. More people fly for their business and more of us are taking a few flights a year on holiday. Tourists want cheaper fares, but if airlines are restricted from flying more because of limits at airports, then prices will not be reduced significantly. But of course, bigger airports with more flights means disruption to residents under the flight path, perhaps traffic jams and more carbon emissions, which affects climate change. Here in the UK, the government has decided expansion of airports like London's Gatwick and Heathrow will boost the British economy, the most important policy of the Labour Party. New runways are taking off and campaigns to oppose expanding aviation are being grounded. This is Russell Padmore for World Report in London.
Finally, we go to Pakistan. A Muslim sect is being targeted by the Pakistani government and a far-right Islamist party in the holy month of Ramadan. The crime that the Ahmadis are being accused of is calling themselves Muslims and reading the namaz or Islamic prayers. Scores of Ahmadis have been arrested by the Pakistani police this month for blasphemy and their places of worship have been pulled down. And so far there are no signs of Islamabad heeding Amnesty International's call not to target Ahmadis for their religious beliefs, which differ from mainstream Islam. Sajida Momin has this report.
The arrest of 60 Ahmadis by the police in Pakistan for reading the namaz or Islamic prayers has turned the spotlight on a little-known Muslim sect, which is considered heretical by mainstream Islam. The arrest of so many Ahmadis, including women and children, in a fortnight is even more significant because of the timing of the clampdown. Two dozen of them were rounded up in Sialkot, Punjab province, just before the advent of the holy month of Ramadan, which celebrates tolerance and brotherhood among Muslims. The rest were arrested in Karachi, Sindh province, during Ramadan, which is being observed with the usual fervour in Pakistan through March. Importantly, the arrests have been accompanied by physical attacks on places of worship belonging to the Ahmadi community, heightening its insecurity and vulnerability. Numbering around 10 million worldwide, Pakistan is home to 4 million Ahmadis, but the modern Muslim nation has unfortunately institutionalized their persecution and harassment by officially declaring them non-Muslims. Successive regimes in Islamabad, whether democratic dispensations or military dictatorships, have banned Ahmadis from even calling themselves Muslims and forbidding them to practice Islam. They are not permitted to read the namaz, even in the confines of their home. Similarly, they are barred from sacrificing animals during the Islamic festival of Eid al-Zuha, when other Muslims slaughter goats, cows, or camels. It is ironical that despite being a modern and progressive Muslim nation, which enjoys the distinction of being the only nuclear-armed military power among Islamic countries, the Pakistani state is complicit in the targeting of Ahmadis not only by extremist religious groups, but by various law enforcement agencies of the government. For instance, the spate of recent arrests is because of the existence of Section 298C of the Pakistan Penal Code, which bars Ahmadis from calling themselves Muslims and practicing or preaching their faith. And such incredible constitutional bigotry emboldens groups like the Tehrik-e-Labbaik Pakistan, a far-right Islamist party notorious for its hardline stand on blasphemy and religious minorities, to vandalize the places of worship and graveyards of Ahmadis, with the state remaining a mute spectator. In fact, the police and Tehrik-e-Labbaik extremists jointly tried to pull down a 120-year-old Ahmadi mosque in Gujranwala this month to shatter the community's morale, according to ground reports. In contrast, Ahmadis are much better off in neighboring India, where they live peacefully and observe all their religious rituals without any fear. Predominantly Hindu India, in fact, has more Muslims than Pakistan. But Indian Muslims, unlike Pakistani Muslims, leave Ahmadis alone to practice their own variety of Islam. India is home to 1 million Ahmadis, which is a quarter of Pakistan's Ahmadi population. But there is literally a heaven and hell difference in the lived experience of Ahmadis in the two countries, which are so similar and yet so different. Ahmadis are considered apostates or outcasts who have abandoned their faith for propagating that Muhammad, who founded Islam, was not the last prophet or messenger of Allah. The Ahmadis believe that their founder, Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, who established the sect in 1889 and died in 1908, was a prophet himself. And this is both unacceptable and unpalatable to Orthodox Muslims, who believe that the last prophet was Muhammad, who passed away in 632. Despite the divergence, Ahmadis live side by side with the two largest Muslim sects, Sunnis and Shias, for many decades in the Indian subcontinent. But with the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, the Ahmadi sect was declared non-Muslim by the Pakistani government in 1974, opening the floodgates of state-sanctioned persecution and targeted mass killings, like the 2010 Lahore massacre, which left 84 dead in suicide attacks on two Ahmadi mosques. Remarkably, Pakistan also succeeded in persuading Saudi Arabia to debar Ahmadis from performing the Hajj pilgrimage in Mecca, which is considered the high water mark in a believer's life. Pakistan is often as much in the news for crimes against minorities as it is for not doing enough to prevent the targeting of Ahmadis, Shias, or Christians. But international criticism or global condemnation doesn't seem to make a difference. Amnesty International, the human rights watchdog, has come down heavily on Islamabad for this month's arbitrary arrests of Ahmadis and demanded their release, dropping all charges, ensuring the protection of their properties, and strict action against the perpetrators. But all this has fallen on deaf ears, just like the cornered Ahmadis' cry for justice. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.